Hi, Joe.
Hello, Jacqueline.
I'm really, it's really my great pleasure to be the first person to do Blogging Heads TV with you.
Thank you very much. It's a treat to be here.
Yeah, so would you like, since this is your first time on Blogging Heads TV, would you like to introduce yourself or say something about what you do at CAP?
Sure. My name is Joe Cirincione. I've been working on these nuclear issues for about 25 years. I started on the staff of the House Armed Services Committee during the administration of Ronald Reagan, and I've worked at the Henry L. Stimson Center. I was a director for nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for 8 years, and now I'm vice president for national security here at the Center for American Progress, a relatively new think tank in Washington.
And sort of the hot place to be with very deluxe accommodations, very unlike the kinds of progressive non-governmental organizations, other progressive non-governmental.
Yeah, this is more of a kick-ass think tank.
Pretty much is. Yeah.
It's a lot more aggressive in getting the message out. It was set up to be the alternative to the American Enterprise Institute and to have a real policy impact, taking the ideas of the progressive community, both in security and economics and in domestic policy, and really getting them out there, both in Washington and throughout the country. So we have, you know, a cities project that links up progressive mayors across the country. We work with governors. We have something called Real Progress that works with film documentary makers, all kinds of interesting things that no other think tank does.
It's a real testimony to what money brought to bear in those objectives can do, because it's clear that they're sort of...
And it's headed up by John Podesta, the former chief of staff from the Clinton White House, who's a terrific guy and has really brought an energy and a vision to this place that I think few other people could replicate.
Well, the first thing we were going to talk about today is your new book. I'm going to hold it up here so everyone can see, Bomb Scare. It's I think, a beautifully produced book. And, you know, I like the kind of feel. It's a slim volume. It's really, I don't want to talk just about the production part of the book, but the substance of it. And I think one of the most striking things about this book, which is how it differs from lots of our colleagues in the nonproliferation community, is that it's a lot more optimistic. And it's sort of threaded with this sense of optimism about the future that I don't think many of our colleagues share. So I thought maybe I'd start by asking you to explain your reasons for being optimistic.
Yeah. Well, it's true. I think the proliferation community is filled with Cassandras and Ihors, you know. They just feel like the end is near and there's nothing we can do about it.
Right.
And, you know, that's just not true. One of the reasons I wrote this book is because I thought it was important to look back at the 62-year history of the nuclear age and to understand the lessons we've learned. You know, we now have a track record. We don't have to debate the proper policies on who's got the better sound bite, although I wouldn't mind doing that. But we can look back and see which policies have worked and which ones haven't worked. We can tell when we did policy A, did it make us more secure or less secure? And three of the, I guess the big reason I wrote the book, besides having Columbia University Press come and ask me to do it, was because I wanted to talk about this love and fear affair that we've had with the bomb for 62 years. The fear part is obvious. You know, these are the most horrific weapons humankind has ever invented. These are really the only true weapons of mass destruction. Of course we fear them. But in our society, fear is often used to manipulate us, to get us to buy products or even wars that we don't really need. But there's this other part of it, which is the fascination part, that has also been there, this dual nature. And it's that fascination, because after all, this is a stunning scientific and technological achievement. Humankind is now able to reproduce the basic energy source in the entire universe. Every time we would detonate a fusion bomb, so-called hydrogen bomb, we were literally replicating a piece of the sun here on Earth. Who wouldn't be fascinated with that? Who wouldn't be drawn to that kind of power? And it's understanding that fear and that fascination and how they've intertwined over the last 60 years that helps us understand the point we're at right now and where we go from here.
Well, I think one of the interesting points you make that demonstrates how far we've come from the Cold War is that the risk of nuclear annihilation was much greater in the 1970s and the 80s. And I think you know, the average person today wouldn't really understand that. So could you explain how it's different today for us? Why is our risk of nuclear annihilation much less great today than it was during the 70s and 80s?
Yeah, people always talk that we live in a more dangerous world now, citing terrorism, for example. But that's just not true. Although the dangers we face now are very real and have to be thwarted, it was a much more dangerous world back in the Cold War. People of my generation remember the duck and cover drills. I remember going to grammar school, and every couple of months the air raid siren would go off, and we'd be led down to the basement where there would be barrels of water and cartons of crackers with those CD, civil defense slogans, or logos on them. Every Saturday, in every hometown around the entire country, at noon, the air defense siren would be tested, and the AM radio, which is all we had, would turn to a test of the civil defense system. I mean, that was real. We were worried about Soviet bombers coming over the pole and destroying the entire country. And then later with ICBMs, about rockets being launched within 30 minutes and destroying the entire planet. When Jonathan Schell wrote his book, Fate of the Earth, in 1982, he captured that threat of global thermonuclear war. We no longer worry about that. We no longer worry about the fate of the Earth. We worry about the fate of our cities. Still a horrific threat, but we have to remember that we have been through and defeated much, much greater threats. And that's part of what gives me hope for the ability of even a flawed society such as those we live in to come up with solid policy solutions that can reduce and even eliminate many of these nuclear threats.
So, you know, we're left today, you know, no longer with kind of Cold War era threats of, you know, mutual assured destruction. And it's just funny. I mean, like, we don't even use these terms anymore. And I think graduate students today of security policy, you know, they don't have to do those circular error probable calculations with their little, like, compass-like devices. And no one talks about flexible response and, you know, second strike survival. It's really gone from our vocabulary in lots of ways. But the terrorism issue obviously isn't. And the nuclear terrorism issue specifically is one that I think people still like to wring their hands about. And I think this is the section of your book that captured my attention, and I'd be interested in your thoughts. The bottom line in your book, and I think it generally, is there is a threat of nuclear terrorism, and the way we're going to go about addressing it is by locking down fissile material around the world. And I guess that's the one piece of it that doesn't really satisfy me. You know, is that really what it all comes down to?
Well, you know, one of the lessons of the last 60 years is that you have to have a comprehensive approach. You can't go around playing nuclear whack-a-mole and trying to have individual country solutions and think that that's going to work. And that's true for terrorism also. So there are many things you have to do. You have to have comprehensive policies that address the root causes of terrorism. In the current situation, I think that includes getting out of Iraq. That's been a huge disaster for us and has given Osama bin Laden the war that he wanted, and has spread al-Qaedaism like wildfire through the Muslim world. So there's part of that, too, that you wouldn't think has anything to do with nuclear strategy, but it does. You have to see the whole picture and be moving all these pieces at the same time. But the key is to secure and eliminate nuclear materials, and the reason is simple. As sophisticated or as wealthy as nuclear terrorist groups might be, they can't make a bomb from scratch. They don't have the money or the industrial capability to build the factories like Iran is building to make uranium, to enrich uranium to bomb-grade levels, or to make plutonium. But if they could get these materials, particularly highly enriched uranium, they could very quickly, with a minimum amount of technical expertise, construct a crude nuclear device, and then it's even easier to smuggle it into the country, and easier still to detonate it. As Sam Nunn says, every step after they get the nuclear material is easier for the terrorists to carry out and harder for us to stop. So the trick is to stop them from getting the nuclear material in the first place. The good news is that we have programs in place that have been run by Democrats and Republicans for the last 15 years the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, the Global Threat Initiative Program, even things like the Proliferation Security Initiative, that can secure and eliminate these materials. The bad news is we've only secured and eliminated about half of them. And if we keep up on this pace, it'll take us another 20 years to get to all of them. And we don't have that time. We're in a race with Osama bin Laden for these materials. So we have to accelerate these programs. And I can't calculate in the book, after talking to many, many nuclear terrorist experts about this, that if we just tripled the funding, say spent about $3 billion a year, or what we spend every week in Iraq, we could virtually eliminate the risk of nuclear terrorism within 4 years. If we couple that spending with high-level presidential attention, a senior, for example, deputy national security advisor to the president dedicated simply to this mission, to nuclear terrorism, we could virtually solve that problem. And I'm waiting for the candidate for president who's going to understand that and is going to set that as a goal. I think it's a winning issue.
You know, I think that all sounds really great. I mean, there are two things. A lot of people kind of conflate the risk of a dirty bomb with a nuclear bomb, and lots of people acknowledge that you're right. You know, to get a nuclear weapon, the real risk is nuclear fighting fissile material, and you know we can maybe address that. Although it does still raise the issue of, you know, we've only locked down half the world supply of fissile material. Why hasn't someone managed to get at some of it until now? So maybe we're just lucky, or maybe it's harder than we realized to, or maybe the people who are, you know, apparently aiming for this material aren't that good at it.
I think it's luck is a big part of it. It is hard to do, which is fortunate. And the programs are working. We have frustrated several attempts at doing this, so it's a combination of those. But you can't count on that. I think our luck will run out.
But do you side with those in this community who believe there's just some inevitability to an attack by a dirty bomb, for example?
I don't know why we haven't been hit by a dirty bomb already. I mean, this is just so easy to do, and it seems like the perfect terror weapon. You know, this is not a nuclear explosive device.
Right.
This takes what a terrorist knows how to do, a truck bomb, a car bomb, and just laces it with radioactive material, not uranium, not plutonium, but highly radioactive material, the byproducts of reactor fission. So cesium, for example, strontium, even cobalt, well, that's not ideal. Those kinds of readily available industrial used radioactive materials, just gram quantities of these in a small satchel of dynamite could contaminate a 10-square block area of downtown, could contaminate the Capitol, the Supreme Court, for example, the financial district of New York, make it uninhabitable for people to... It wouldn't kill people. It's more like asbestos. It clings to the walls and would increase your risk of getting cancer if you inhaled it. I really do expect to see that device used with, she's almost 100% certainty, sometime in the next decade.
Well, now you've just depressed everyone. Here we were talking about your optimism in the book, and you think it's...
Well, the good news is this is not a nuclear explosion.
Right,
it doesn't detonate. It doesn't destroy downtown Manhattan.
But it does a level of economic damage to, you know, having to tear down buildings and rebuild. I mean, that's on a massive scale of you know, that is as an economic weapon. So now we're thoroughly depressed again. One of the things, there is going to be a dirty bomb. There probably won't be a terrorist nuclear weapon. That's the bottom line.
Well, if we just keep doing what we're doing, I think there will be a terrorist use of an explosive nuclear device. That is part of the message. I mean, there is a real fear here. There are real threats. There are evil people who want to kill us. And we have to do something about this. So there's nothing automatic about this. What I'm saying, the reason I'm optimistic is because I know there's a set of policies out there, and there's widespread consensus on this from, you know, from Harvard to Stanford. People agree on this. It's just that we haven't had political leaders with the vision to actually implement that, and by that I mean in the White House, House, either in Democratic or Republican administrations, who have understood this and have made the number one national security threat to the country their number one national security priority. I think we can do that. I think we have an opportunity, but the clock is ticking. We don't have much time.
Well, one of the things I like about, and we can just talk about this one other thing and then move to another topic, but one of the things I did like about how you, you know, addressed the policy issues in the book is, you know, you laid out very, very clearly, I think, the shortcomings and successes of, for example, the Bush administration approach to nonproliferation. They have a long laundry list that, officials like to recite, beginning with Libya and including AQCON and the Proliferation Security Initiative, which I think smart people can debate about. But you point out that, these are successes, and they're worthy of our gratitude and praise, but at the same time, there are some really significant failings, and I think that those, you would argue, and you know, feel free to address this, are on a kind of larger scale, and that's what, you know, I think isn't clear, I think, to people, that that it doesn't all begin and end with Libya giving up some centrifuge some centrifuge components and the Khan network.
I was at a conference at UCLA chaired by Wesley Clark a couple of months ago, and then Undersecretary of State for Nonproliferation Bob Joseph gave the luncheon address. And a wise guy blogger put up and says, you know, there's nothing quite so good for putting you to sleep as hearing an administration official detail their proliferation successes for 45
minutes. That's brilliant. Who was the wise guy blogger? Do you remember?
I'm sorry. I didn't get his name. I just saw the blog.
That would people's eyes glaze over.
And that was really true, particularly on a warm L.A. afternoon.
Well, I hate to say this, Bob Joseph,
the Proliferation Security Initiative is a good idea, and it's a useful tool to add to our toolbox. Right. And Libya is really the biggest success. It's the sort of the Libya model has now been established. But the failures far outweigh the successes. And that's because these guys came into office determined to fundamentally change. And they write this in their national strategy, How to Combat Weapons of Mass Destruction. They talk about a fundamental change in the proliferation policy of the past. And what they're talking about is overthrowing 50, 55 years of bipartisan consensus that the focus has to be on negotiating agreements to eliminate the weapons themselves. As John F. Kennedy said, we must abolish the weapons of war before they abolish us. And these guys said, no, that's not the way to go. What we want to do is replace multinational negotiations on focused on weapons with direct U.S. action, primarily military, that would eliminate regimes that have these weapons. So they engaged in this choosing of good guys and bad guys. It's okay that India has nuclear weapons. In fact, maybe they should get a few more. It's not okay if Iran has them. It's okay if Israel has them. It's not okay if Iraq has them. It's okay if we have them. It's not okay that North Korea has them.
Well,
and the war in Iraq was the first implementation of this strategy.
Right.
The idea was we were going to eliminate not just the alleged nuclear threat, but deter others from going down this path. When John Bolton, then Undersecretary of State, 4 years ago, was asked what lesson North Korea and Iran should draw from the war in Iraq, he said, take a number. And that was the idea. We were going to go on a roll. We were going to eliminate not just the regime in Baghdad, but the regime in Damascus, the one in Tehran, and even in Pyongyang, or at the very least, intimidate them into giving up their programs. It's been a disaster. Every single proliferation problem, except for Libya, has gotten worse, not better, in the last 6 years. So for me, and for analysts like me, I think our number one job is to document this failure, to show the historic record of this strategy, what they thought was going to happen, what actually happened, and then explain why this failed, and show how to take some of the elements that did work and forge them into a new bipartisan nonproliferation strategy.
Well, as you point out, the shining example of success, Libya, of course, wasn't about regime change. It was
the opposite.
Policy.
Instead of trying to change the regime, we changed the regime's behavior. And instead of the Iraq model, which was has been extremely costly in treasury and blood, has backfired. And by the way, we didn't have to do it in the first place. You have the Libya model, which cost us almost nothing. Nobody died, and it was 100% successful. Muammar Gaddafi's nuclear program is now in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. It's all locked up, and this guy has gone from the poster child of a rogue state leader to a man that George Bush calls a model that others should follow. We've reestablished diplomatic relations. U.S. companies are investing in Libya. Libya is being integrated into the rest of the world. It's an extremely productive model to follow.
The Libya case is also an interesting example of when a dictator has adult children who grow up and sit them down and say, hey, Dad, this whole thing, the kind of Arabist, Maoist, Green Book thing, it's not working out. It's not a good
strategy. Yeah, that's right. His son had a big part to play in this over years, convincing the great leader that what he was doing wasn't working. And they had a real challenge from Islamic fundamentalists in their state. And unless they improved the economic situation, they didn't have long to last.
Well, this kind of foreshadows a little bit the final observation that I think you'll. But if we sort of were to sum up in kind of three bullets the biggest lessons that we should take from our nuclear history, the last 60 odd years of having the nuclear weapons as part of our military defense. What would those lessons be?
I would say what the scientists pointed out back in 1945. There is no quantitative or qualitative advantage in nuclear arms that can give you security. If there's anything we've learned, it's that. The better our weapons and our quantity of our weapons don't give us security. Even when we outnumbered the Soviets 20-1 during the Cuban Missile Crisis, we were deeply insecure. The second, I think, is that there's nothing inevitable about proliferation. We've seen it come and go. And in fact, in the last 15 years, more countries have given up nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons programs than have tried to acquire them. And the third, I would say, is the need for a comprehensive approach, that you have to understand that there's linkage between existing state arsenals, including ours, and the desire of other people to acquire these weapons, that there's a connection between international laws and regimes and force, sanctions, or the threat of military action, that you have to understand how to use this force of diplomacy together. And I guess, finally I'd say that there's a real connection between the underlying conflicts in a region and the proliferation imperative. You're never going to convince Israel to give up its nuclear weapons unless you resolve the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. You're never going to convince India and Pakistan to give up their weapons unless you resolve the Kashmir crisis. So you have to spend a lot more time on conflict resolution, not just on signing treaties.
So speaking of Israel and persuading Israel to give up its nuclear weapons, or taking a kind of intermediate step and just persuading Israel to open up some of its nuclear facilities, create a little transparency, engage in some confidence-building measures with its neighbors. What would it take to persuade Israel to take some sort of small baby steps toward dialogue and transparency?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I talk about in Bomb Scares is this interesting study done by Patrick Clausen and Henry Sikolsky, fairly conservative proliferation experts. And they talk about a series of steps that Israel could take, for example, shutting down the Dimona reactor, which is where they've been producing their plutonium, which is due for pretty much at the end of its lifespan anyway, but it's the kind of confidence-building step that Israel could take, reaffirming the Israeli policy of working towards a Middle East free of nuclear weapons. Which is something that Ariel Sharon reaffirmed just 2 years ago during a visit by Mohammed al-Baradei, the head of the IAEA. There's a series of things like that Israel could do. But in the bigger picture, clearly, Israel psychologically is never going to give up their nuclear weapons, even though they have no real role in their security anymore, until they, one, resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and two, we've developed a regional security framework for all the states in the region that respect each other's right to exist and respect each other's borders. Now, those are tall orders, but we've done this in the past. I mean, look at Europe. Europe hasn't had a war in 60 years. Now, that may seem like a short time to some, but it's the longest period in European history that they've never had a war. That is the bloodiest continent on earth. And look what we've done with Europe. Look at South Africa. There's majority rule in South Africa, something that people in my generation never thought was going to happen. We can resolve these issues. It just requires work and persistence. And once you establish that kind of security framework, then it becomes apparent that Israel's real security interests lie in getting rid of these weapons, not keeping them, because they have a conventional superiority over any Muslim state or combination of Muslim states, and they have an interest in preventing those countries from getting the one weapon that really could threaten Israel, a nuclear weapon. So sooner or later, and I think it might be sooner than people think, Israel's going to take its bombs out of the basement and put them on the negotiating table.
Well, it's a chicken or egg issue, especially with Iran in the picture, which there's been a little bit of Iran news this week about its... I don't know if you've read the New York Times today, or there was a post article about it.
Are you kidding? I'm talking to you. Of course I read the New York Times.
Okay.
I read every scrap I could get on the Iran situation.
Okay, so...
I'm trying to level the playing field.
So here we have Israel that you think is ready... To maybe take its bombs out of the basement.
Well, and not ready. I'm just saying sooner than people think, which was still years off.
Okay. All right. And we have, you know, Iran just determined to show the world that it has mastered the nuclear fuel cycle better than anyone ever expected that they could. The latest news is that Iran has introduced uranium hexafluoride gas at what we understand is low pressure, low rate. Speed into about 1,300 centrifuges, which is a lot. Which is a lot of centrifuges.
Yes.
Don't you think?
Yes, it is, because we were looking at about 300.
Yeah.
Just a few months ago, two cascades of 164 each, which is troubling in itself, and now they've just leaped forward to 1,300.
So
that's a significant
capability. Are people starting to run around with their hair on fire about this? I know that officially national intelligence estimates haven't changed and everything, but this is a big number, and they could easily be at 3,000 by May or end of May, early June, even if they're not working perfectly, even if they're crashing, and even if they've got lots of problems to overcome. They seem to be muddling through. Would you agree with that?
Now, here's what I think about this. I think these guys are racing as fast as they can to establish facts on the ground.
Right.
It's a little like the Israeli settler strategy. You know, you want to establish these settlements as quickly as possible, even if it's just four or five guys in one house in a remote village. You know, you want to establish this and then make it much more difficult for either the international community or your own government to reverse it. Because remember, Ahmadinejad is in a political struggle within Iran itself. There are a whole lot of politicians, pragmatists, who are perfectly willing to compromise on the nuclear issue for a greater strategic gain. So Ahmadinejad and the officials who support this program are racing ahead to do this. But it's a little like a Potemkin village here. I mean, they put the centrifuges up.
Right.
You know, Potemkin village is with the foreign minister of Russia that created facades of villages. So when Catherine the Great was going by, he would think his policies were more successful than that they actually were, that there was prosperity in the countryside when there wasn't. I think they're putting these things up as quick as they can to create this impression of a consolidated, achieved capability. But I think there's a big difference between putting up even 1,300 centrifuges and getting them all to run together, and getting them all to run together consistently, and then producing the real industrial quantity of fuel. Even with 3,000 centrifuges up, I still think it's going to take them years to perfect these techniques and get to the point where these machines represent an actual serious nuclear threat to us.
I completely agree with you about racing ahead to establish facts on the ground, and I completely agree that it could take them a long time to really get up and running. But what I'm not so sure about is where their technical roadblocks are coming. I just think we don't know. I just think there's a great deal IAEA safeguards inspectors don't know, and that Iran hasn't revealed. And I think given that level of uncertainty, one shouldn't rush ahead to worst-case scenarios, but I think it's prudent to at least consider the possibility that... the Iranian nuclear program has always been about scale, and it's pretty much unfathomable that they'll ever have 50,000 centrifuges up and running producing enrichment services for reactor programs in Iran and in the region, which is what they say their eventual objective is. So if you take away that possibility and instead you examine the possibility of a weapons program or a covert weapons capability, then 3,000 centrifuges, maybe not running so perfectly now, but maybe running better in 3 years, that really is of concern, I think.
Yes, I agree. If they could get 3,000 running openly, then you really do have a serious concern about 3,000 operating covertly. Because obviously, if they're operating openly, you can see them. They're being inspected, and you would know, are they producing low enriched uranium or high enriched uranium? And but what's your guess? 3,000 Iranian centrifuges would take them, what, about 8 months of steady work to produce enough material for one bomb?
Or what if they just stockpiled LEU for 24 months and then had a covert cascade of just 1,000? I think even if you do the math there,
what is the math? If you do that, if you have LEU stockpiled they pull out of the MPT and they start feeding that in, how long does it take them?
It reduces by 75%. The work required to get to a low level of enrichment is the majority of the work that you need. So if you run LEU through a cascade, I think it's in 1/4 time you can produce what it would take if you were starting.
So if you had a cascade of 3,000 working, instead of taking you say 12 months to do it, we're talking 4 months, maybe even 3.
Exactly.
Something they could do. And with a 1,000 cascade, maybe a half a year, three quarters of a year, but net get enough for one bomb. Yeah, that's a serious case. Now I got to tell you, I think that they're much further away from that capability than 3 years. I just can't believe that these guys, on their own, now with no other additional help, you know, the Pakistani connection's been cut off.
Right.
No one else is helping with them. I don't think they can get there in 3 years. Now, it's true. It's an assumption. It's my sort of hypothesis about this. But I think they're going to pay for this rush job of putting these centrifuges in, just the way the U.S. is paying for its rush job of trying to put missile silos for interceptors up in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, they got them in, but they don't work.
Right.
And now it sort of sets back the whole program because you've really squandered a lot of capital into a system that doesn't work. We'll see, but my hypothesis is that we're going to start seeing the Iranians have significant manufacturing problems with these centrifuges they've installed.
Yeah, the only thing about that, and not to push back on it, but just to point out that, you know, they're running P1 centrifuges. These are early first generation machines. I refer to them, I think, as the Honda of a centrifuge. It's not, yes, they're delicate and hard to balance. All kinds of things can go wrong. Lots of things can go wrong. And there's this issue maybe of impurities in their uranium hexafluoride, and Jeffrey Lewis has suggested that they're husbanding their supply of Chinese hexafluoride, which they only have 1,000. I think it's one ton. They have a ton of it. So there are definitely things that could go wrong, but they are able to manufacture indigenously all the parts they need for the P1 centrifuge, unlike later generation models.
Yes, that's true.
So that's another. So when you and the IAEA hasn't been allowed to have a look at their production facilities since early 2006.
Well, let me ask you this: you talk to these IAEA guys. What are they telling you? Have you had some consultations since their last visit?
I haven't spoken directly. I've been on email contact with a couple of people, but I think right now the IAEA is trying really hard to get its act together for the next report.
Yeah.
Due to the Security Council, I think that there's a little bit of radio silence from Vienna and from the inspectors on the ground, and I think they're.
Well, let me ask you a tough question here. Let me turn the tables on you. And before that, I want to, you know, give a plug for Jeffrey Lewis. His blog, armscontrolwonk.com, really has tremendous detailed discussion of these Iranian centrifuges. It's really some of the most accessible. You know, ISIS does great work on this, but Jeffrey sort of spices it up with pictures and snide comments, and it's fun to look at both your sites.
Right.
The issue is this, you know, if we had made a deal with the Iranians when they first offered a deal in April of 2003, when they came to us with that famous offer or suggestion of an offer, that's the way these guys work, suggestion of an offer that maybe we could talk and we could resolve this whole suite of issues, you know, we could, if we had worked then, there wouldn't be an Iranian program. They didn't have any centrifuges up and running. We could have shut it down then.
Right.
If we had made a deal even a year ago, you know, we could have got something that compromised on maybe a test stand of centrifuges working someplace in the pilot facility. But now, it really makes it difficult to envision a deal where Iran completely rolls it back. Now, my position is, and we put this in the Center for American Progress report, Contain and Engage, that we should have no enrichment activity on Iranian soil.
Right.
But I got to tell you, as they build these, it makes me feel like that eventually is going to have to be a compromise that allows them to do some, at least research work, with, at this point, probably hundreds of centrifuges. And I wonder what you think about that, where you go.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously there was that great shining moment in 2003 that I don't think people were really aware enough of, the magnitude of that offer. I mean, the Bush administration totally lost an opportunity, but I don't know that people were seized with this as just like major opportunity right now. I think some people were. I think people maybe like Bob Einhorn understood that. But so big missed opportunity. And then, of course...
Yeah, or Flint Leavitt, who's written about it extensively.
Right. And then, of course, you know, the goalposts move, and suddenly Iran wants, you know, more and more centrifuges, R&D capability, how do you define it? And I think David Albright agreed, you know, I think his bottom line, ISIS's bottom line, was that there should be no enrichment capability in Iran, and as you noted. And now I think you're absolutely right. I think now, you know, we're sort of choking now on this realization that, you know, facts on the ground have completely changed. Now, maybe it's a Potemkin village, maybe it's a Potemkin Cascade Hall. We'll find, but I guess the bottom line is this going to change the calculus of countries like Israel in the region? How are they going, you know, knowing everything we know about how hard it might be to get these machines to operate in unison, is that going to be enough of a, you know, how is that going to change Israel's calculus of whether it can live with 3,000 imperfectly operating centrifuges? What do you think?
Israel has repeatedly said, and I think this cuts across the entire political spectrum, that they cannot tolerate a nuclear Iran, and there's every indication that they're willing to take the risk of what would happen after an attack for the what they feel is the certainty of allowing Iran to continue.
So
while I think there's a low probability of either an Israeli or American military attack on Iran now, the longer this is unresolved, the higher the probability of that.
Right.
And as these tensions increase, there's always the risk that something can happen in the region, say another American seizure of Iranian officials, Revolutionary Guard officials in Iraq, that could blow up into a shooting match that could trigger a larger conflict.
This is exactly the risk.
If Iran is not stopped, a year from now, I think the risk, you know, during an American presidential election, risk of an Israeli attack gets significantly higher.
Right. So how do we take this off the table now? I think people are really at a loss now because it just seems the leverage isn't there. The Security Council sanctions. I don't know.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, these sanctions, you know, the economic sanctions economically directly don't really, you know, have that much of a bite, but they've had enormous financial and political impact in Iran. Iran was shocked when the U.S. didn't blow it and kept the U.N. Security Council united in December and got Russia and China to support this.
Yeah, and it's true.
They were very surprised as well
just
a couple of weeks ago when Indonesia and South Africa and Qatar joined the Permanent Five in a unanimous Security Council resolution increasing the sanctions. And the sanctions have a bigger bite now. For the first time, there's a non-nuclear issue involved. They ban Iranian arms sales or transfers to anyone, which means, by the way, that Iranian transfers to Hezbollah would now be illegal. And UN forces operating and patrolling the borders of Lebanon could actually seize or stop such transfers.
I think some people have pointed out the
Bank of Sefer.
Yeah, right.
And starts cutting those off. So there is financial pain that Iran is feeling now. We do have leverage here, diplomatically and financial. There's an investment crisis inside Iran. The question is, you know, can we couple that sort of that pain, that containment strategy, with an engagement strategy? And this is what I think is missing from the U.S. strategy, such that it is, that this failure to recognize that you've got to give Iran a way out, that you've got to, and that time is not necessarily on our side now, that you've got to start direct negotiations with the Iranians to convince the pragmatist in Iran that there is a deal to be made here. The price of that deal has gone up, but I think there's a deal that could be made here that could get a suspension of the Iranian facilities and negotiate towards a very limited enrichment facility, and that would then buy us the time to work on the more fundamental issues of transformation of the policies of the Iranian government and the nature of the regime itself.
Well, I think we can agree that the next 2 to 3 months are going to be really critical. We're going to know a lot. I mean, whether these centrifuges are working, whether they're crashing, whether they're having problems, how much UF6 they begin to feed, I think that's the key thing to look at, if the IAEA is able to report that kind of information. And then the UN obviously will take this up in about another month or a little more than a month. So I know we don't have that much more time. And there was sort of a note I think we wanted to end on. I think what you defined as the great coming moment. So why don't I just ask you to explain what the great coming moment is going to be?
You know, well, we have all these individual problems: North Korea, Iran, nuclear terrorism, thousands of weapons still on hair trigger alert aimed at the United States and Russia, and U.S. weapons aimed at, I mean, Russian weapons aimed at the U.S., U.S. weapons aimed at Russia. We have all these problems that we have, and they're all very complicated. But one of the reasons I'm optimistic about our chances now is I see a change in the wind. Things are starting to move, partially because we have this opening that's coming in the next two and a half years, where in 2009, 4 out of the 5 permanent members of the Security Council are going to have different executive leadership. The United States, but also France, the United Kingdom, and Russia is going to change. And this is true for other countries as well. Iran is probably going to have a different president. They have elections in 2009. We have a changing of the guard in international leadership. There's already a new UN Secretary General. There will be a new director of the IAEA in 2009. It's almost a unique political transition where you get new people coming in, and that means they have the opportunity to make really substantial changes in proliferation policy, among other national policies. And at that same time, you see a whole lot of very smart, dedicated people working on a new proliferation policy, a new nuclear posture for the United States and for the world. I know there's at least a half a dozen groups in Washington doing this. I'm involved in 3 of them. And most significantly, they include people from both Reagan administration, Clinton administration, even going back to the Johnson and Kennedy administration who were involved. I've been very encouraged by the op-ed a couple of months ago in the Wall Street Journal, signed by 2 former Reagan Secretaries of State, George Shultz and Henry Kissinger, Clinton's former Secretary of Defense, Bill Perry, and the former Chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Sam Nunn, all calling on the U.S. to reaffirm the goal of elimination of nuclear weapons as part of a comprehensive plan to move more aggressively on stopping the proliferation of these weapons. When you see hardline conservatives like that, people who presided over the great nuclear buildup of the 70s and 80s, now saying that we have to reaffirm their elimination, things are changing. There is a wind blowing on this issue that I think is going to lead to a lot more progress than people believe over the next couple of years. And this is not a one-shot op-ed. These guys are dedicated to it. It's being pushed by, of all people, Max Kampelman, who is a hardline conservative in the Reagan administration and has been, you know, beating the drum on the elimination of these weapons now for years. That's why I'm confident that we can get, perhaps not this administration to change its policies, although one can always hope, but that the next administration, whether Republican or Democrat, is going to have a very different nuclear policy than the failed policies this crowd brought in and tried and found didn't work. So, Jacqueline, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
This has been a real pleasure, and I'm glad
through.
We could leave on a on an optimistic note.
2009, it'll all get a lot better.
Onward and upward.
Yeah. All right. Well, it was great. It was great doing Blogging Heads with you, and I'll look forward to doing it again sometime.
This is a great format.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.